I am Justice Bill Meyer, and I will be presiding judge today. To my right is Justice Birdwell, and to my left is Justice Simmons, who is visiting with us today. We'll be your panel for your case. Counsel ready? Would you please call the case?
The court will now call Ronnie Patrick Schindler versus Patrick. May it please the court, Mr. Richard A. Henderson to argue for the appellant, Mr. Jacob Mitchell to argue for the state.
Counsel, are you ready?
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
It's kind of an unusual situation for me since to be in front of Justice Birdwell, since he and I practiced together some years ago, and it's interesting to see somebody, we're getting more lawyers with appellate experience on the bench.
You'll probably see him for a while, counsel.
Well, I hope so. I don't think he's that old, but I know he is the expert on the extension.
So. Yes, I am. Thank you very much.
Sometimes in cases we need to step back and just see what happened. In this particular case, I'm sure you've read it. It involves an attempted service by a district attorney investigator on my client. And while we've raised issues of whether it should be a preponderance or beyond a reasonable doubt standard, constitutional issues, this case doesn't pass muster under any standard of evidence. Most of the forfeiture by wrongdoing cases involve cases where the witnesses were murdered, or they were repeatedly threatened, or as in one of the cases we have here in Texas, there were 39 jail calls. None of that happened here. This district attorney investigator went out to serve Mr. Schindler's wife. He knocks on the door. He doesn't ring the doorbell. Nobody comes to the door. He drives off to the local school to see if the kids are registered there. And he comes back and he doesn't knock on the door again. What he does is park about 200 feet away. Mr. Schindler starts backing out of his driveway and sees this man. And he testified that he had seen him walking away from his door while Mr. Schindler was in a towel or just coming out of the shower. Said, who is this guy in a neighborhood where there's no other outlets in my neighborhood? So he drives up and starts talking to him. And he figures out that he's a DA investigator with a subpoena for Mrs. Schindler. And they have a conversation. And according to the investigator, there's some dispute between Mr. Schindler and the investigator as to whether Ms. Schindler returns from a jog or whether she drives backs out of her car to leave. But the investigator states that he's blocking me. He doesn't ask him to move. And the investigator testifies, well, I felt like if I were to pursue her, she would evade me. Well, there was no evidence that she was going to evade.
What exactly does the record show in terms of the blocking? From the briefing, it appears that the only blocking in terms of the actual testimony is that of the service provider can't open his door. It seems from both briefs that if he wished to drive forward, that he's not being blocked. If he wished to back up, he's not being blocked. So when you're referencing blocked, and I'll ask counsel this as well, what are we talking about in actual blocking?
I don't have the answer to that. I think there was no actual blocking. The investigator, the DA investigator says he never asked him to move, and he actually stated on the record, I mean, I guess if he had been completely clear, he wasn't going to drive after her because he thought she would evade him and cause some kind of hazardous incident. But there's no evidence of that. So I agree with you, Justice. There's nothing really to show that he was blocked. And he never came back. This was the first trial setting, I think you can see from the record. And he never tried to serve her again. And he testified that the reason he never tried to serve her again is that he feared that my client would harm her. There's no evidence of that. He could have come back out there. He could have made another attempt. I mean, those of us that have practiced civil law would say that would this have been enough evidence for substituted service in a civil case?
Well, there's some evidence that he might have harmed her because he has a previous conviction for harming her, correct?
Certainly, but if that's the case, then why did he come out there to begin with to serve her? It's my opinion. It's my response to that. And the thing is that he never really, there's never any evidence that he was going to harm her if she was served with this subpoena.
Well, what are we looking for in terms of the case law? You're correct that at least two of the cases cited by the state were dealing with death and or some type of assault.
Correct.
Okay, so is there a temporal aspect to this that the cases talk to us about? Can we focus solely on the one attempt made here, or do we have to look at the one attempt in the context of the greater opportunity?
If there's another case that even closely resembles this, I haven't been able to find it. It looks like they wanted to make this a test case of forfeiture by wrongdoing. And under these facts, I think it's the wrong case. It's just, there's really nothing to indicate. And he could have come back that afternoon. Mr. Schindler went off to work. They never even tried again to come serve her. And they have all this speculation about he's going to harm her, she's going to run and cause a evade service. I mean, if she's going to evade service, what does that have to do with Mr. Schindler?
How are we to make a determination based upon the case law of where the line gets crossed between coercion on the part, prevention, wrongful prevention on the part of the defendant, and a reluctance on the part of the witness? Has there been any kind of bright line discussed in the case law between inferring, you know, that prevents us from inferring coercion based upon merely reluctance of the witness and vice versa?
I don't see any case, and this set of facts, as I said before, sometimes we have to step back and look at the facts. I don't see one here. If they're saying that what Mr. Schindler did that day by backing up and talking to the, or driving up and talking to the DA investigator with the subpoena, and then you see the woman either come out or go in, whichever. I mean, I just don't see any case law.
Let's assume, just for purposes, that since we are required to look at this from the standpoint of the trial court's evaluation of abuse of discretion, and the trial court has authority to determine credibility, let's say there's sufficient evidence here for the trial court to conclude that there was some type of coordination between the defendant and his wife to prevent service here, that he essentially is confronting the service provider, making it impossible for him to get out of his car, and coming close enough for a form of intimidation, and then the wife leaves under the circumstances. Why is that outside of the discretion that the trial court has to determine whether or not to determine the credibility of the witness here as to what his intent was, et cetera, with regard to this? Why is that beyond a reasonable inference that we can make in favor of the trial court's determination?
Well, and both the state and I have used the definition for abuse of discretion, which is something that is so clearly wrong as to lie outside the zone within which reasonable persons might disagree. I'm certainly urging and believing under these facts that reasonable persons might disagree on the discretion of the trial court and what she ruled. I mean, I don't know if you even have probable cause to believe that he was trying. Probable cause is a lot less than preponderance of the evidence.
Well, he doesn't have to actually commit a crime, correct?
No.
Just has to be wrong.
The statute says that.
Okay. I'm sorry, counsel. I mean, judge.
So the trial court appeared to rely on the fact of this prior assault. And case law does say that that is one thing that can be taken into consideration. How would you weigh that?
No, I mean, it had happened, but under these particular facts, on that particular morning, on that particular day, to try to say, I mean, why didn't he ring the doorbell? Why didn't he try to come back? I mean, it would have been a very simple thing to do. Could have tried more than once, and there was something else additionally, but under this flimsy attempt to serve her, I mean, you can go back and say, if that were the case, then he forfeited his rights by wrongdoing before the guy came out there that day. Period. We don't need to serve her because it's too difficult. He's going to block it. He's going to prevent it. And here you've got the guy in plain clothes, unmarked car, and never another attempt. I mean, I just, to come up to say that is a preponderance of the evidence and not abuse of discretion, you're going to be really establishing a different line of the law. This has nothing to do with somebody threatening somebody, somebody killing somebody.
Well, we know in domestic abuse cases, there's oftentimes control where financially and through children and other ways the spouse is controlled and is too afraid to come and pursue testimony in the trial court and that sort of thing, right? I mean, that does happen.
Is there any evidence here that that's what happened that morning?
Well, she had three children.
And testimony was she was at home.
She was dependent on him for financial help.
Certainly. But the thing was, if she was at home that day, Mr. Schindler testified that he would like for her to come down to the courtroom, and she wouldn't come. And
counsel, you haven't mentioned a part of the record where there was some discussion of numerous telephone calls attempted by the district attorney's representative that were not accepted or returned.
Well, if she wasn't answering the phone, as he testified, it's her decision to answer the phone or to return the call. Ms. Schindler had her own mind as to whether or not she wanted to come down there. It doesn't mean that Mr. Schindler was threatening her or coercing her.
She had in her own mind the past history of abuse.
I mean, if you want to look at it, that's the state's argument. Certainly it is. But as far as what are the facts of this case, on this particular day, what did Mr. Schindler do to prevent her being served? And what prevented the DA investigator from coming back out there again? There's just nothing.
I hear your argument mainly discussing what might have been done as opposed to what was actually done.
Well, they actually talk about more about what might have happened, that he might have coerced her, that she might have run, but there's no evidence of it.
So could the trial court take into consideration not only the prior assault, but also the circumstances surrounding the assault that actually was going to be tried, you know, outside the presence of the jury, and could take into the circumstances about his driving and the children's feeling threatened and things like that?
Well, that is the state's argument.
Well, but is that, in your mind, do you agree that the trial court could take that evidence into consideration as well?
I think it could take it into consideration, but if you look at the overall set of facts as to what happened that day and subsequently, in which there was no attempt whatsoever to make another service, and there's no evidence on that particular day that she didn't come to the door, that she wasn't there, or that he couldn't have come back. But again, the yellow light's on. I just want to mention that I think it's kind of a case of first impression to say that preponderance of the evidence should be the standard. I know the state's position is that if it's a preponderance of evidence for the evidence to come in, does not mean that that is violating the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. But none of this evidence is coming in to convict him beyond a reasonable doubt unless the court finds by preponderance that he somehow prevented the service and therefore forfeited his rights but by wrongdoing.
Don't you have to rely on your constitutional arguments for that? Because, of course, we find that in statute, right?
Correct.
In the statute. So then we have to say that either the statute is unconstitutional.
Well, I think the statute is unconstitutional.
Right, okay. And talk to me about preservation of error of that.
Well, when you're sitting there and you're in the heat of battle and you're trying to preserve error, when you say this is the wrong standard of proof and it therefore, I think if it's not specific, I'm out of time.
Go ahead and finish your sentence.
If it says that you are you have alleged a constitutional violation in due process, and you've alleged that the wrong standard of proof was used. I hope I made sense. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, may it please the court. I'll first just briefly address issues 2 and 3, the constitutional challenge to the preponderance of the evidence standard, and then the constitutionality of the forfeiture by wrongdoing statute. The state's position is that those issues were not preserved for appellate review. The objections at trial are objecting to the evidence coming in under the statute, and not putting the court on notice that actually a facial challenge or an as-applied challenge is being made to the statute. And I think the basis of the argument, the context of it, the evidence that's put on is there enough evidence here of the wrongdoing for this to apply? So I first address those and say I don't believe they were preserved. If the court does find, though, however they were preserved, it's well established from the U.S. Supreme Court down that forfeiture by wrongdoing is a doctrine that operates as an exception to a confrontation clause, and that the preponderance of the evidence standard is the majority approach. It's the approach in the federal system, the standard by which the wrongdoing must be proven. I cited in my brief a number of other states in considering the same issue. They use a preponderance of evidence standard, and that is the appropriate standard to apply here. Because we're not talking about a separate criminal offense, we're talking about forfeiture by wrongdoing, for which beyond a reasonable doubt must be proven. But submit to you, if that was the standard, then we could just go ahead and say anytime a criminal defendant has tampered with a witness and the state has proof of that, then we have an exception.
Okay, where's the evidence of tampering here?
Justice Berger, my point is not that we have to prove.
Well, tamper's a term of
tampering.
Art. Tamper's a term of art, which implies wrongful conduct. The case law is absolutely clear that anything here that permits the forfeiture, there has to be some form of wrongful conduct. Okay? So what is the wrongful conduct here?
The wrongful conduct goes to his actions, that of the appellant, the day that Investigator Couch goes out to serve the subpoena. But we don't consider just that event, that occurrence, in isolation. As the Supreme Court has said, in a domestic violence context, we're going to look at the classic nature of this type of relationship. And even Justice Souter, in his concurrence to the Gill's opinion, talks about often in a classic abusive relationship involving domestic violence, the intent of the abuser to procure the unavailability of the complainant can often be inferred from the relationship alone.
But that's always in the context of action, okay? There's nothing in the case law that says that merely because you've been accused of this type of abuse that the court can then infer that any unavailability of the witness is a result of the abuse itself, because then you end up with a tautology and not an actual standard of law. So explain to me how we get to wrongful conduct in this particular instance.
Okay, and I agree with you, that's correct. Otherwise, it would apply in every domestic violence case. The conduct the day the Investigator Couch goes out there to serve the complainant, Ms. Espinoza. Once the appellant comes out, he backs up his car within about a foot of Investigator Crouch's car. And your earlier question, what are we talking about when we talk about boxed in? That's what the testimony establishes. Investigator okay. Crouch.
Parallel? They're parallel? Is that what they are?
Was there actual use of the word boxed?
I don't believe the word boxed.
We're being really careful here. Blocked, but then that was my question, was blocked.
Right. The appellant pulled his vehicle so that his driver's side was next to the driver's side of Investigator Couch. So their two driver doors were right next to each other. And Investigator Couch testified at the hearing on determining whether 3849 applied that the appellant had pulled his vehicle within about a foot of his vehicle. He could still move his vehicle forward or backward. So yes, not boxed in.
In what direction was the house? Was the direction in front of the service, of the server, so that he could have pulled up to the house, or was he away from the house and looking behind? He would have had to have backed up.
Right. It was my understanding from his testimony, he was facing the house, parked about 150 to 200 feet away from the residence, watching these events take place. And then after he'd been about 15, 20 minutes, the appellant backed his vehicle out and then pulled down into Investigator Couch's vehicle so that their two driver's side doors were next to each other. And then he was able, as they sat there and talked, to continue to see the residence because he saw Ms. Espinoza come out of the garage and move a vehicle. But to your question of once they're parked like this, Mr. Couch testified he could have opened his door, but he could not have exited his vehicle because it was parked too close. And so he admitted in the hearing that he could have moved his vehicle, maneuvered his vehicle, but he could not, as they were parked, open it and have gotten out to go and on foot pursue Ms. Espinoza and serve the subpoena.
But didn't he say she was driving away?
He said at one point she backs out and pulls away, and then later in that testimony he said he didn't see exactly where she went. The appellant, when he testified in the hearing under 3849, he testified that she actually pulled her vehicle into the garage. So she came out, got in the vehicle, parked on the street, pulled it into the garage, and remained at the house. And so I think Investigator Couch and the appellant had different testimony as to where she actually went after he'd last seen her.
So even if the trial court believed Investigator Couch, there appears to be no actual stricture on him from following her. He's looking right at her, getting in a car, and he is not obstructed from driving forward and driving after her. Would that be correct from the record?
From the record, yes, Your Honor. I think we're still looking at the actions of the appellant. And he, at the point that Ms. Espinoza exits the residence and comes out where they can see her, he knew what Investigator Couch was there for. Investigator Couch had already informed the appellant, I'm here to serve her a subpoena, and they'd acknowledge this case is pending.
But that was after he pulled up next to him, and they exchanged the discussion.
That is correct.
Okay, there was no interaction at the house or at the door between them.
No, Your Honor. The interaction between the appellant and Investigator Couch was there while they were in the vehicles, kind of the second time he'd come to the residence. He went first, knocked on the door, no one answered, left, and then came back. And that's when he and the appellant had contact. But when she exits the residence and they see that, it would be reasonable for the appellant to pull down there and ask, what is some guy in an unmarked car who's been knocking on his house is doing in the neighborhood? At the point he's been told by the investigator why I'm here, what I'm doing, and the person exits, Ms. Espinoza exits the residence, the appellant should have moved his vehicle if it was not his intent to continue to have Investigator Couch remain there in his car. The person who was there to serve was now out and open in plain view, and he remained parked there, keeping him in his vehicle. And it was Investigator Couch's decision, with his years of experience, to not whip his car around, go and pursue her in a vehicle. He did acknowledge in the hearing that there was nothing that indicated to him she would flee, but that was his concern, that he would escalate this this occurrence out there, and so he did not. But had the appellant not remained parked there and moved his vehicle, knowing why the investigator was there, he could have exited, served her, and then this case may have had a different posture once it got to trial. But Investigator Kaus was not able to do that.
In your brief, you discuss some other factors. One of the things you discuss are the fact of the children and also the financial arrangements being supportive of this fear that Mrs. Espinosa or the woman had. And I don't see any case law cited. Are there cases that basically rely on those factors, such as the living arrangements and the fact, we know this happens, but I mean, I just didn't see any reference to any cases that dealt with either the financial or the children in terms of this statute.
The case law that supports that and those factors being considered is the Monash Maryland Supreme Court in Gills, and that we consider the nature of this relationship. We don't consider it in isolation. And forfeiture by wrongdoing is something that could come to play in many other type of criminal cases, but we're often not confronted in a domestic violence situation. And in Gills, they recognize that this is a particular statute to apply in that context. And in doing so, we look at the relationship. Those factors that I laid out in my brief are factors that I think relate particularly to this case of why his actions that day in this context would then render her unavailable, why she would not want to come to court and testify.
In quite a number of cases, though, the fact that you have a stay-at-home, perhaps a stay-at-home wife or stay-at-home partner, then that would be sufficient evidence then to support this forfeiture by wrongdoing?
It's evidence to support his intent for the act he engaged in, okay? The act of preventing service that day is the act that he engaged in, his wrongdoing. And then he had to have done that with the intent to procure her unavailability.
So financially supporting a spouse or a domestic partner would be evidence of intent to preclude them from testifying?
It would be evidence of how he exercises this control over her.
Okay.
And unfortunately, this is common factors in a domestic violence situation, but they exercise this control through financial dependence, through remaining in the kids' lives, through isolation. And so then when law enforcement comes into play and you go out and prevent them from serving this person that you have kept in isolation dependent upon you, that is evidence supporting what your intent is in doing that wrong conduct.
I want to return to Justice Simmons' question of opposing counsel, and that is, the only reason you know what the relationship is that you're urging is because of the statement that you're trying to get in. Is the interview with her at the time of the incident, and how are we to allow you to use the very evidence that you're trying to be excluded, that's being challenged, in order to justify its inclusion? We don't know anything about the level of control, the number of children, anything of that nature. Did either of the officers who actually were at the point of the assault that night actually testify, or in this particular hearing, or was the trial court solely going based upon the substance of the very statements that were being sought to be excluded?
The trial court in the hearing under 3849 had Ms. Espinosa's written statement. That's what was offered before her, and then the testimony of Investigator Couch with the testimony of appellant. There was later evidence put in trial as to her responses in what we call the family violence packet that expanded more on this relationship, but that did not make it into the record in the hearing under 3849.
Well, was the statement from Ms. Espinosa admitted for purposes of showing the relationship, or was it admitted solely as the basis of the evidentiary challenge?
Both, Your Honor. It was admitted in that hearing to show the nature of the relationship, what happened here, so that the trial court could also determine, is this a statement that I need to make a ruling on? It's a testimonial statement.
So the defendant objected to its admission at trial, And then during the hearing, didn't object to its consideration by the trial court with regard to whether or not it should be admitted at trial?
Yeah, at the hearing, the objection by defense counsel was that the state had not met its burden of proving by preponderance of evidence that there was a wrongdoing here, that the events that happened out there that day did not meet it. They also objected and said that believed that the standard should be beyond a reasonable doubt. At trial, then, is when the objection comes to it being admitted and under the Texas U.S. Constitution. And at various times when some of her statements were offered, an objection to hearsay was made as well by defense counsel. But what was put in the hearing was her written statement detailing the events that had happened. And the objection was that at the end of that hearing, the argument to the trial court, rather, was that the state had not met its burden of proving the wrongdoing.
Counsel, I'd like you to expand a little on the statements you made in your brief about there being telephone calls made and not returned, and also to identify any other attempts to obtain service that we hadn't talked about this morning.
Yes, Your Honor. There were no other attempts to go out to the residence. That's what the testimony at the hearing established. Investigator Counts did testify he made phone calls to try to get in contact with Ms. Espinoza, but had not spoken to her or received a return call, and that he had searched her work history to determine if she worked somewhere so he could attempt service there, but had not gotten anything current.
All right. Thank you very much for your argument. Counsel, are you have rebuttal?
Again, we have to go back to what happened that afternoon, that morning. There is no evidence that Ms. Espinoza or Ms. Schindler even knew that he was there and what he was there for. I think it's very simple to understand that if somebody knocks on your door, you're in the shower, you see them walk off, and the investigator testified he went probably a half hour or more to the school to see if they were registered there, and he comes back and he parks 200 feet away. I think Mr. Schindler's actions were very reasonable in coming up and saying, what are you here for? They strike up a conversation. There's no evidence that Lauren knew that he was there and he was trying to serve her. There's no evidence that she even saw him talking to Mr. Schindler. And then you have her driving off and nothing to block him from following her, only his speculation that he thought she would evade. Well, why would she evade if she doesn't even know who he is? There's no evidence to say who he is. And he could have said, I'm going to go tell her or whatever. He never even tried. He just said, enough, I'm quit.
Could the trial court not have inferred, reasonably inferred, a reluctance on the part of Ms. Espinoza to testify by her failure to return phone calls that are directed directly toward her?
Reasonably infer is a really loaded term.
Because we're making a determination of whether the trial court acted reasonably here.
I think that is speculation by the trial court. I don't think the court could reasonably infer that her refusal, we don't even know if he was dialing the right number or had a current number. But
the combination of a failing to return phone calls, testimony that in fact she and the defendant are living together, which was observed by Mr. Couch, okay, coming in and out of the same household, the prior conviction for domestic abuse in 2005, as opposed to the substance of the statement in this particular instance, why is it unreasonable for the trial court to put those things together and infer that, in fact, there is some type of coercive atmosphere that is creating an inavailability of this particular witness?
I would concede that you might, using that inference, get up to maybe probable cause. But as far as reaching preponderance of the evidence, using that that inference, you'll never get there. That, you know, this whole set of facts that he tries to serve her, and who even knows if he tried to serve her? He knocks on the door, and she doesn't come to the door. And he's talking to the defendant, and she drives off. He makes no further attempts. Is that even an attempt? And then you say he calls her, and the phone calls are not answered. I mean, you're really reaching, in my opinion, honestly reaching, in my opinion, to get to a preponderance of evidence that would stand up in a civil trial. And it certainly shouldn't stand up in a criminal case.
Counsel, do you have a comment to make about the absence of testimony from the victim wife having an impact on the state's case in proving the crime that he was charged with in this instance?
Well, Judge, when they start running in the police reports and things that were otherwise inadmissible, once they say forfeiture by wrongdoing and open the floodgates, they're going to run over you. And
that's not my question. The question is, would the wife's in-person testimony in court have been a preference of the state in presenting its case against Mr. Schindler?
That I cannot speculate to. I don't know.
You don't know?
Whether the state thinks that she would have come in. Mr. Schindler testified he was trying to get her to come down there to testify more about what happened.
You believe that?
Yes, sir.
He wanted her there.
He did want her there.
Thank you, counsel. Gentlemen, thank you for your briefing and your argument this morning. Your case is submitted, and you will hear from the court when the decision is made and printed. And thank you again for being here today with us. Okay, the court will be dismissed.
The Honorable Court of Appeals of the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned. You're dismissed.